This episode, I'm joined once again by Brian Counter to discuss Cormac McCarthy's novel Outer Dark, alongside discussions on the work of Schopenhauer, Plato, and the philosophy of nihilism. I'd like to say a big thank you to all my paying patrons and subscribers for making everything I do here possible. And if you have enjoyed anything that has been published on the podcast this year, please think about subscribing as the podcast runs off patronage alone. Otherwise, please enjoy. So, Brian Counter, thanks once again for joining us on Hermetics Podcast.
Yeah, happy to be back on. Thanks for having me.
So, we had this idea to discuss the work of Cormac McCarthy and Schopenhauer. You emailed me about Outer Dark, which is McCarthy's second novel from 1968, definitely from the early period, and from the very early period, of course. And this novel, I guess, the early stuff, bit more so now, but it seems the early stuff doesn't get as much of a look in compared to, like, of course, Blood Meridian, but then also the Border Trilogy. These are the two that get perhaps the most attention, and now the latest work is sort of, I guess, befuddling a lot of McCarthy scholars. But you emailed me about this Schopenhauer, and also I think sort of inverted Platonism connection in McCarthy. So this conversation will probably be generally around McCarthy, around Schopenhauer, around literature, about symbolism in literature as well.
Yeah.
To set the stage for this, I just want to read, this is literally from after one of McCarthy's common things that he does, after a piece of prose, we begin the actual story, and this is pages, so the first really two pages of the novel. So to begin, "There was a prophet standing in the square with arms upheld in exhortation to the beggared multitude gathered there, a delegation of human ruin who attended him with blind eyes upturned and puckered stumps and leprous sores. The sun hung on the cusp of eclipse, and the prophet spoke to them. This hour the sun would darken, and all these souls would be cured of their afflictions before it appeared again. And the dreamer himself was caught up among the supplicants, and when they had been blessed and the sun begun to blacken, he did push forward and hold up his hand and call out, 'Me,' he cried, 'can I be cured?' The prophet looked down, as if surprised to see him there amidst such pariahs. The sun paused. He said, 'Yes, I think perhaps you will be cured.' Then the sun buckled and dark fell like a shout. The last wire-thin rim was crept away. They waited. Nothing moved. They waited a long time, and it grew chill. Above them hung the stars of another season. There begun a restlessness and a muttering. The sun did not return. It grew cold and more black and silent, and some began to cry out, and some despaired, but the sun did not return. Now the dreamer grew fearful. Voices were being raised against him. He was caught up in the crowd, and the stink of their rags filled his nostrils. They grew seething and more mutinous, and he tried to hide among them, but they knew him even in that pit of hopeless dark, and fell upon him with howls of outrage." So, one might have noticed there a relationship from the book and the world, specifically, I think is the most important thing. The agency of the world and the world has a relationship with, empirically, the sun, but darkness and light. And that's where I'll hand over to you.
Yeah. Well, one thing, if I can extend a tiny bit, what you read, right, the line right before where you started is just the single line, "awake from this dream," which, you know, we understand as meaning awake, like he's being shaken awake from the dream that's then described. But, you know, it's also an ambiguous line that maybe is asking us to awake from some kind of dream in a way, right? So I think, like, in terms of where I'd start talking about that passage, I mean, when I was reading this, I took notes every, and this is my habit lately because I've also been thinking a lot about light, but anytime light was mentioned, I've taken a note where it's mentioned. And if I look at my notes right now and just search up light, I have 76 hits in my notes for the word light. So to start, I guess, by first positing some kind of connection between McCarthy and Schopenhauer, and I'm sure we'll kind of backtrack and say more about Schopenhauer. Schopenhauer has these two passages in World as Will and Representation where he talks about how he has this long section about aesthetic experience, which he talks about in a very different way from Kant. I think he's like kind of trying to complicate a lot of what Kant is doing, and it's not the exact same kind of discussion of transcendental conditions for aesthetic experience. Schopenhauer is a little bit more concerned about like the actual experience that we could have of aesthetic, you know, of nature or of art. And so he mentions that, you know, his whole big thing is willlessness, right? Like we need to be, get out of the trap of the principle of sufficient reason and no longer have our ordinary everyday will. That's how we find ourselves as an expression of the capital W greater will. I'm not too necessarily convinced of the entire, you know, structure that he's talking about, but what I do find fascinating is that he maybe sort of typically at first he talks about light as being light and vision as being the mode of perception that's least dependent on the will. So he says that we can, and the example he gives actually is that light can illuminate without warmth. So we can have a cold light on a winter day. In fact, let me find the passage here. One thing he says is the delight we take in light is therefore, in fact, nothing other than a delight in the objective possibility of the purest and most perfect intuitive mode of cognition, and as such can be derived from the fact that pure cognition, liberated from and rid of all willing, is highly gratifying and already as such has a great share in aesthetic enjoyment. So light, you know, we know that light sort of in literature and in philosophy kind of dominates, right? Because we have this optical or visual paradigm, where those, you know, light, vision, seeing clearly are, and light in the first place is aligned with knowledge and goodness, you know, and this is a huge part of the symbolism, especially, you know, Christian symbolism that we could find in McCarthy. But I think, and maybe here I'll throw it back to you because I'm going on here, but I think McCarthy's answer, which I think is the correct one, is not, you know, his answer to that paradigm or that trap that we could find of light always being some positive good force in the world. And I think this is the correct sort of answer, is that he's not simply retreating into darkness and unknowing. I mean, certainly he's there's some unknowing and there's a lot of darkness here, but I think it's a much more complicated and neutral kind. So we find darkness over and over again, but we also find light. Like we find light in this novel again and again, but it doesn't really tell us anything, right? And so if we are thinking of this as like an allegory or as some kind of, you know, the biblical symbolism is all over this novel as well, that's posited, I think, to show, at least in a certain way, and this is maybe where it's nihilistic, that allegory itself is kind of, arbitrary, right? Like we can read that allegory, but we can also read this as a reading it literally, which I tend to do, you know, reading this very literally as a novel that that kind of is not really trying to tell us how to read it.
I'm in agreement with what you said, that the light isn't revealing anything, which is a real it borders on horrifying, but the problem is it doesn't it bolsters the unknown. So, I mean, to draw in Schopenhauer again, we focused on book 3 of volume 1 of The World of Representation, which is specifically on Schopenhauerian aesthetics, which is obviously the most relevant here. But this notion that for Schopenhauer, that when we contemplate something aesthetically, in the aesthetic sense, we don't have knowledge of the object as an individual thing, as a representation. If we truly contemplate it in that aesthetic sense, it's rather a universal Platonic idea. And so, like, for me to draw these threads together, because I do think Plato is the other, he's negated very quickly in a very sardonic fashion. But this notion that you pointed out of awake from the dream is for me synonymous with get out of the cave. Like, you didn't even get that choice. So, you know, Plato's cave, we're tied up in the cave, we're chained in the cave, whatever. And we're watching the shadows, we think they're reality. When we get out of the cave, of course, one of the first things that we're approached with is light. And I think the presumption philosophically for so long with regards to Plato's cave and this duality completely is really a logocentric duality of, like, you know, the cave is underground, you're in the... There is also, like, a later, I guess, Christian appreciation of, you're in the underground, you're in hell, you're in the base desires. You come out of the cave and then there's the light, which is sort of symbolically synonymous with the higher coming down, angels, God. And, you know, you see the truth symbolically from the Platonic version. And then moving through to Schopenhauer, of course, and he's moving through from Kant, you have the notion that there is, in some sense, a way to engage with the thing in itself, but it's sort of almost a contemplative, not ignorant, an unknown, borderline mystical, I would say, for Schopenhauer, contemplative, giving oneself over to something. And in that sense, you have the aesthetic experience in the Platonic sense. But the difference with McCarthy is that he doesn't presume that light is good. So really, not in Outer Dark, at least, which is why I think it's most nihilistic. So when we have that section at the start, where for me the thing that stands out is that to say that the sun darkens, I mean, that's a horrifying absurdity. And there's a certain agency of the sun to almost have an agency of, you know, you get the Platonic light, you don't get the Platonic light, you get actual light, you don't get light. Yeah, the world is empirically illuminated, but the sense in which certain people get the symbolic light is to what extent the world actually is going to open to them as an aesthetic experience. And what we find in terms of the plot with Colour and I think it's Rinthy, I think, these siblings who are in an incestuous relationship, who have just had a child, which is then very quickly buried in the woods by Colour because he's ashamed. We have the most sinful archetype of a relationship here. And so it's like, you guys get... You know, the world's going to be lit for you in the empirical sunrises, sunsets. But Colour just constantly has this relationship with yeah, it's illuminated, but you don't know anything. And there's something particularly, yeah, horrifying about that, that just to throw in, I think, a film that does this very well is Rosemary's Baby. You know, something is going on in a completely lit world, and you do not get to know what it is. McCarthy doesn't even give you a conclusion, unlike Rosemary's Baby. But so that for me is this inversion of the going through Schopenhauer, an inversion of the Platonic idea, or at least a flattening of the Platonic idea, which is then, we'll get to this later, is then subsumed into Calvinism of no agency, which is why this book is just kind of horrible, to be honest.
Yeah, I mean, picking. I have a few thoughts. I mean, first of all, the Rosemary's Baby, I like that comparison, and it makes me think, this is a whole other, I guess, conversation, but makes me think of a lot of those, you know, Italian horror films from the 70s where they're like almost neon, you know, there's like so much light, and it almost feels perverse, and it feels even more horrifying than something that would be, you know, a lot darker, you know, like literally darker. It makes it darker because it's so light. And I guess interestingly, you know, Schopenhauer hated Hegel, so maybe he's not intending to think about it this way. But I do see, like, first of all, I mean, thinking about that, you know, awake from this dream, what I notice about the passage that you read is that, you know, Colour, if Colour is the dreamer there, he's, you know, he's surrounded by lepers, and there's no indication that he, you know, he stands out among them, right? The prophet is surprised to see him there. So he's not, you know, he doesn't need to be saved in this same way. Or he doesn't need to be saved in the sense, or cured or healed in the sense that these like lepers with whatever stumps and sores and everything need to be healed. he needs to be healed from this world that would allow that, I think, right? Or he needs to be healed from like the possibility of seeing this happen out in the world. And it's as if like his being saved is him buying into this idea of allegory or idea of symbolism or idea that light will save him. So that's him being saved, which means that he's removing the hope that he would actually be able to be saved at the end, I think. So he wants to the ability to buy into this thing and have his journey be guaranteed when it can't, I think. That's partly how I understand it. And especially with, you know, the sun darkens and then we get all this light throughout the rest of the novel, right? So there's a lot of gray light, there's twilight, there's faint light. And everything that it's, you know, illuminating is very bleak. But to touch a little bit more on the Schopenhauer thing, I mean, it's also important to remember that for Schopenhauer, you know, aesthetic experience is a moment of, you know, relief from suffering. Like it's not, you know, we talk about aesthetic experience as pleasurable, but even then, I mean, there is this kind of relation where, you know, when we are acting more rationally and by habit and all of these things that fall under the principle of sufficient reason, that's the suffering of being in the world, right? And aesthetic experience for him, the way I understand it, I might be wrong, but the way I understand it is that it's like a moment out of time, because we, you know, we become absorbed in the object. The normal relations no longer apply. Subject and object to a certain extent merge. We also are just, even in an empirical sense, we're no longer concerned with, you know, our day or something, right? And so I think it really complicates, you know, we find this in Kant too, but there's this kind of tension between how you use the term genius, because for Schopenhauer, this is the one who thirsts after aesthetic experience. For him is the genius, and the genius has the ability to contemplate in this purely, he calls it objective. I kind of would disagree, I think, to a certain extent, but he says this objective and will-less way. That's the genius, is the one who can do that. However, he also says that the genius, you know, verges on madness, because the genius, can't really handle, you know, the normal sort of contemplation that we need to get around in the world and things like this. So there's a danger to becoming, you know, and it's unclear how purposeful or intentional it is, but becoming too invested in this kind of aesthetic experience can be like a dangerous thing for the genius, I think. But I guess that, yeah, the tension I see too is that for Schopenhauer, there's like this idea that one has genius, but there's also the genius. Like there is the person, the figure of the genius, who is a person. So the idea of it being like an empirical versus a transcendental thing, I find to be maybe instructive for thinking about. I'm not saying that anyone in this novel is a genius. I'm just saying if we think about how these experiences are happening and how they could be related to a way of contemplation that does or does not find in light something pleasurable or something illuminating in a more objective or transcendental sense. There's a question of, you know, what kind of agency these characters have and whether they're just being subject to a larger thing. And I guess this is where the allegory, you know, the biblical allegory comes back in as well.
And to just draw on one of the points you made about this notion of aesthetic experience being something out of time, well, I guess out of time and space in a way. Maybe, you know, it's tough to say, but outside of or engrossed, so much engrossed within the a priori's of Kant that it becomes this other thing, a certain liberation. And if it's a liberation from anything, it's a liberation from the Schopenhauerian pendulum between boredom and suffering.
Right.
And the thing about this is when it's this aesthetic experience, which, you know, is something that is illumined by light, is given over to us as something that we can perhaps fall into, to use some fairly hasty language. You know, in the Schopenhauerian sense, we're talking about getting away from the world as representation, which I always try to, you know, always pronounce in my mind as representation, right? Like, so, you know, the representation of Kant and of Schopenhauer is a representation of the world because it had to be filtered via, you know, the human sensibility, the human senses. And to get away from representation is to fall into I guess in a way, a sort of pure will-less subject of the aesthetic experience, which gives you that liberation from boredom and from suffering, however momentarily. Right. And I think the horror, you know, just jump back to that, and the real nihilism of the novel is that the opportunities that are written for color and written for the reader to have that liberation, for him to have that liberation, are immediately deflated by McCarthy as clearly not instances of actual aesthetic experience. The world isn't offering color anything like this. So when the openings are given, well, at least this is my own appreciation of it. When the world of this novel opens up the possibilities for that, it reveals that maybe actually color is having the aesthetic experience, but there's nothing in it which can actually give him any liberation. You know, waking up from the dream, he's almost in the real, and when it's illumined, it's not going to change anything. And color strikes me as oddly a very bored and disgruntled individual who's accepted the suffering and is more actually on the side of the pendulum with boredom. He's very accepting of the world that he's within, and we're very quickly placed within how horrible that world is in an atmospheric sense. But this does bring to the question of agency, which I think is the other key cornerstone here. And some people have noted that there is this Calvinist determinist agency within this novel of... Really, it seems clear from the beginning that Colour and Renthy are in a life of sin, and it's not entirely sure really until you really get going with the novel of whether or not they have any say in the trajectory of what's going to happen. And I do wonder if Colour is somewhat intuitively understanding of that, and it's almost what to do in that situation where the path that you're about to take is really not anything to do with your own agency. And at no point along the path, because of that lack of agency, and because of you are literally just a sinner, you know, and you're destined for hell in the Calvinist sense, because of that, none of these experiences come through in the Schopenhauerian sense once again. So there's this twofold relationship between you are determined to live this life of sin and this, you know, really destined for hell, and this is your lot in life, and almost because of that, it negates any possibility for illumination. And it's interesting that maybe one could say that Rinthy, you know, the way her story ends, because the two stories between the two characters are split throughout the novel, the way her story ends is by going to sleep again. So Colour stays awake, and Rinthy gets to at least return somewhere.
Yeah, well, I would add to that too, that I mean, whatever, you know, life of sin, and whether this is, you know, a general trajectory or what, maybe it's a threefold thing, because it's also not pleasurable. It doesn't seem at all to be pleasurable for anybody involved, right? The only sort of you know, and this is maybe one place where we see like a lot more of that clear biblical allegory. But you know, the trio, as they're called, right, who are roaming around. I mean, they have this almost, I guess, literally vampiric, you know, moments of excess that seem to be, I mean, eminently sinful, right? But sinful in almost a cartoonish way, not sinful in any kind of realistic, you know, Colour and Renthy. That's to me, you know, if we are talking about sin and talking about this kind of allegory, that's a much more realistic and less absurd and over the top than these three murderers. I mean, I wonder then if we're thinking, opening up the question of you know, agency and trajectory more broadly, you know, there is the fact that Colour is kind of like haunted throughout the novel, right? So he leaves, whatever happens, right? He leaves the baby, he leaves, and then he's just kind of like chased from place to place. So he first, where is it? He goes and asks for a day of work, and then, you know, kind of botches that because he didn't really figure out the terms of the job, right? So he, like, he doesn't eat, or he doesn't, you know, the guy is trying to be nice to him. He ends up stealing his boots and fleeing, and then the trio kills that, you know, kills the guy whose boots he stole. And so it's like everywhere he goes, the trio shows up after him, until he runs into them after the shipwreck sort of scene. Right. I don't know. This is still something I'm kind of trying to, like, puzzle out, because there's, if you think about another way to think about light, is to illuminate a clear path, right? Like, light should, you know, lights along the road or something like this, or, you know, the light in a metaphorical sense can, like, illuminate a path, a desirable path to go on, right? And so all the light that we get is just this kind of uncertain atmospheric light, you know, that is atmospheric in a true sense, because it doesn't really tell us anything.
Absolutely. And I mean, for me, this question goes back to the one of agency, of whether or not there was whether or not the only decision in the novel was the one of responsibility regarding the truly sinful act of the novel, which was the incestuous relationship. You know, the shame that Culler feels regarding the baby and the killing of it is secondary to whether or not he is going to sort of own up to this and just accept what's happened and you know, have anything to do with this child. But instead he makes that decision. And I guess in a Calvinist sense, once again, there's the question of whether or not that was ever his decision at all. But then there is this case, you know, you speak of the trio, which are, you know, he goes to get the job, and then he kills the squire who's helping him. Then he goes to another job for painting, and the trio turn up there again. And the same thing about two or three more times. Then eventually there is this, the shipwreck, with the horrible scene of the pigs running off the cliff. And at the end, the child is...
I think it's still alive.
Still alive, sorry. Yeah, but it's now charred and horrible.
The tinker finds it, and then they kill the tinker because the tinker is strung up. And
they begin to eat it, right?
Yeah, yeah. So they kill the baby in front of him. So there is this way that, I mean, it does feel like very obviously intentionally plotted. I mean, this is like a masterful plot from McCarthy. But this again, to go back on it, to go back to that early point about, you know, Culler wants to be saved from seeing horrible things in the world. Well, he leaves the baby there. He doesn't kill it. He leaves it in the forest, and then even finds it again by accident when he's trying to get back to the house at the beginning. So he, like, weaves this path through the forest after he leaves it, and then he comes upon it again, and then just kind of, like, leaves again. Almost like, you know, there's maybe a chance for him to take it back up or something, you know, but he chooses not to. And then, you know, the tinker finds it, and somehow this trio gets possession of the baby. And I think he's still alive because McCarthy makes a point of saying that the baby didn't make any sound, right? When they slit its throat, and it's a truly awful scene, but he's being made to look again, right? He's being made to, when before he wanted to walk away without seeing this thing, and then thereby somehow maybe be saved or cured in that allegorical sense. You know, he's really being forced to watch this, like, awful scene. And it's right near the end of the novel too.
I mean, is that the aesthetic experience that he gets, but beyond the veil of, not to be crass, I mean, but is that, you know, he's time and time again, he gets this choice, but the world has nothing to give him. I mean, for me, oddly, the main character in this book is the world, because the world seems to just, you know, you could say that the path he takes is due to the world, but the atmosphere of the world and the notion of the light is just constantly the thing that's in charge. And for me, it does seem that Culler, but perhaps not Rinthy, he's There's this notion that he's aware of it, that he is somewhat aware of the way the world is. And I think when I remember first reading it, the way the world is immediately set out and the feeling that McCarthy gives the reader of the world is the first thing that gives you this almost justification for this decision that he's made regarding the baby, that Culler is almost making this very horrible, rational decision regarding he does not want, I mean, which probably is his actual decision, you know, that he just absolutely does not want the baby, which is a product of incest, to ever exist within this world, because he sort of know, there's this intuitive sense that he knows the repercussions. And, you know, already him and Rinthy aren't, they're living really in this very just horrifying nomadic, not maybe not nomadic, sorry, hermit-like existence, in a sort of shack tucked away. And the Tinker, who is someone I just don't, you immediately don't trust and comes across to me as very horrible and kind of greasy, you know.
Yes. The one character you get a clear image in your head of, at least, because this, I think we discussed before that we both like maybe don't visualize stuff when we're reading or have a hard time doing it. But for me, the Tinker to me seemed to be this kind of like grossly laughing, dirtied.
Absolutely. Like he's like, and Culler, you know, Culler, I think is, this is the scene, you know, it's very, the one thing I'll say about the novel is it moves really fast, and to hold on to the plot is often absurd because there is so much sort of horrifying misery and nihilism going on. But, you know, very quickly we're introduced, you know, very quickly the baby is, we understand the relationship, the baby's tucked away, thrown away in the woods, and then we're introduced to the Tinker. I may have got those in the wrong order. My apologies. But when we're introduced to the Tinker, this is where we do get this insight into Culler as a character, because he doesn't want anything from the Tinker. He's very explicit that he does not, you know, I don't want any, and the things the Tinker are offering him are useful. You know, it's like, I think it's like coffee. And he does
pornography.
Not.
He tries to give him pornography, and Culler says, no, I don't want. So again, this, like, there's no, you know, like there's this even almost a refusal of pleasure, maybe, right? I mean, in this world for him, because there's a scene, he's like showing him dirty erotica pictures or something, and he's like, do you want to buy this? And no, you know.
And we know Culler is intuitive, like he understands the world enough to want this guy not anywhere near him. But he also, at the same time, he's already made his, you know, his almost like ultimate sinful mistake. So there's this horrible bind that he's in where it's almost like nothing will make up for it now. And the only thing that would make up for it is this decision that he's given time and time again to maybe take the baby back. But I don't think that even seems like a possibility. Like, what would he do with it? Especially in the horrible situation that they're in. I mean, I think maybe the giving up of the baby is actually just a practical decision for him, because they're clearly extremely poor alongside being brother and sister. You know, yeah, I mean, as to why he makes this decision, I guess is a different thing, but yeah.
Yeah, I would be interested to think more about some of the descriptions. I mean, the naturalistic descriptions here too, because I think that I think maybe looking at some of that will help contextualize some of these questions, because I think they do remain as questions, but they get deeper as questions if we think about how, you know, how we actually see the nature in this novel, in the world, I guess, right? Like more generally. But so the very end of the novel is to give a spoiler, right? He sees Culler runs into this blind man who, again, another interesting thing about light and vision. The blind man says, "It's good to see the sun again, ain't it?" So, a really strange moment where we almost have a feeling of, it does kind of feel in a way almost like the end of the road, actually. Like it feels like a moment where maybe we're going to get some redemption here, if that makes sense, because he sees this blind man who, in a way it's a strange conversation, but feels like maybe one of the more pleasant, in a way, conversations that we've had so far throughout the novel. Mm-hmm. It's just Culler arrives somewhere else. It says in later years. So time has passed, right? So he's still, we don't get any, any real sense of time throughout the novel either. Mm-hmm. There's no, the whole novel's is really just a series of vignettes in a way, connected by these and then punctuated by these strange parts in italics that we can also maybe think about. But This blind man asks him for a cigarette, and he doesn't have any. And then Kala says, "I don't have the habit." So there's also that aspect too that we could think about with Schopenhauer. But then what happens? I mean, the blind man seems to just walk directly into a swamp, and so there's no indication like of why. You know, I mean, he's blind, I guess, but he can also, in a way, he says he can see, and you know, he can see the sun. But to see the sun, and we don't know if it's cold light or hot light. Maybe he can just sense the heat from the sun. But then the blind man, it's the last line. Someone should tell a blind man before setting him out that way, right? Mm-hmm. So the blind man is like ostensibly going to go walk into a swamp and, you know, drown or whatever. Mm-hmm. So even the physical characteristics are part of this, physical characteristics of nature are part of this winding road and kind of aimless narrative that we get. And light obviously is part of that, as we've been saying, but not only light either.
Yeah, and the conversations with the blind man is very much a McCarthyian trope. It appears in many of his novels, this sudden sort of meeting a blind man in some place who's become very wise. And I think for McCarthy, I mean, he consistently has this kind of world where the world itself is very much a character, or at least has this sort of strange mystical agency. And the notion of the blind man, I mean, the blind man, especially in Outer Dark, is, you know, very much accepting. You know, like, he doesn't have to ask for anything possibly from God. You know, the blind man, once again, in the Schopenhauerian sense and also in the religious sense, metaphorically speaking, has become completely reliant on, especially in this kind of world, has become completely and utterly de facto reliant on faith to even exist, to live, and is completely given himself over to that. And I think, you know, perhaps there is a certain sense of mystical intuition on his behalf. But then the whole thing is brought, you know, if he was just left alone to sort of be a faithful person and accept whatever's God's going to give him, because he can't almost second guess it in terms of this revelation in terms of light. Like, he doesn't get that, so he just has to be faithful. If that was just left alone, I think there wouldn't be too much of a question there, as you know, as much at least. But then it ends with the walk into the swamp, and you are, is that a good, you know, is that a good thing? You know, this man who has become completely trusting, completely faithful because of his blindness in this Schopenhauerian world that we've outlined, if people agree with that analysis, is the walking into the swamp actually part of his, you know, because empirically, of course, you could talk about, well, his feet are going to get wet and he could go, I've walked into the swamp, I'm going to turn around. But this clearly isn't what McCarthy is writing. He's writing this about sort of the notion of that is where that man is meant to go, and then brought into question of someone should tell him, well, someone could have. And the notion of someone telling him isn't even a thing, because he's walking into a swamp. He's not an idiot. You know, his knees would be caught, you know, he'd be soaked, right? And he'd turn around. So it's not a question of whether or not someone could tell him that was where he was meant to go as the blind man. Now, whether or not that is a good or a bad thing, that's the sort of, or the third option, which is even more horrifying, is that just an absurd thing that happened at the end, and the illumination, any possibility of actual understanding from illumination is now negated, you know, that there is nothing that can be had by any sense data. You know, take away sight, okay, this man would have smell and hearing and everything else, almost like a complete negation of any sense data. It's just brought into, there's no direction or trajectory which is cohering into an understanding. This world is like horribly absurd with regards to what can be revealed. You know, there is never a moment where the veil of, for Schopenhauer, the veil of Maya, like the veil of representation, is pierced and you get like enough of a kernel to navigate yourself or anchor yourself. It's like every decision is just, well, we don't have anything to go on here. That might be going too far, but I'd be interested in your thoughts on that.
Yeah, no, I it reminds me, because my friend Chris Villa, who has a YouTube channel on called Leaf by Leaf, where he talks about books. I I didn't realize he had a video about Outer Dark, but I was like looking to see if anyone had, you know, maybe had a video. And I watched his video, and he mentions just that very thing. So how, you know, the novel is so disorienting in all of its parts, not only in, you know, we don't get the regular disorient or, you know, regular disorientation of like some experimental novel. We get a much, I think, deeper disorientation. And maybe this might come back to the Blanchot discussion a little bit that we had about, you know, it's almost impossible to not just orient yourself in terms of the events of the novel, but orient yourself in terms of like how this novel is talking about itself, or how this novel is, how the narrative voice is like considering these events, if it is at all, you know? And I have another thought, I guess, but I'm going to, if it's okay, I'll read just that last two paragraphs here. So this is after, it's the same day. It's on the last page. It's after Culla has talked to the blind man. The blind man has kind of gone on. And it says here, I'll just read it. Late in the day, the road brought him into a swamp, and that was all. Before him stretched a spectral waste out of which reared only the naked trees and attitudes of agony and dimly hominoid like figures in the landscape of the damned. A faintly smoking garden of the dead that tended away to the earth's curve. He tried his foot in the mire before him, and it rose in a vulvate welt, claggy and sucking. He stepped back. A stale wind blew from this desolation, and the marsh reeds and black ferns among which he stood clashed softly like things chained. He wondered why a road should come to such a place. Going back the way by which he came, he met again the blind man tapping through the dusk. He waited very still by the side of the road, but the blind man passing turned his head and smiled upon him his blind smile. Holm watched him out of sight. He wondered where the blind man was going, and did he know how the road ended? Someone should tell a blind man before setting him out that way. So, like, I guess just right off the bat, we again here are kind of like baited with these like specific, I mean, we do get, you know, on one level, like, the novel is saying, well, these trees are in agony. It's like the dead, the field of the dead here. You know, we have this almost overdetermination of, negative, you know, perhaps again, biblical symbolism of the damned and, of pain, nature in pain. Right. But then we have this kind of, in a way, idiotic blind man who just not only smiles at Culla, but knows he's there to be able to smile at him, right? So question of how, what kind of, you know, sense data that he's taking in that's allowing him to know. So if he can see someone on the side of the road or know that they're there, then he certainly knows there's going to be, you know, a swamp up ahead, which I'm sure you could smell anyway in the first place. But the other thing too is that, you know, underneath, if we think a little more literally about a lot of the descriptions, we do have there's like symbolism, right? There's this symbolism that maps on perhaps to like a biblical symbolism or even a good and evil symbolism. But we also have something that I noticed a few times throughout the novel is like dissonance, like specifically like dissonant things, dissonant sounds or dissonant situations. That doesn't necessarily map quite as clearly onto like any symbolic structure that we could think of. So like again, here it describes the reeds like clanging, and he does say that it's like things chained, right? But a stale wind blew from this desolation, and the marsh reeds and black ferns among which he stood clashed softly like things chained. So there is the chained thing, right? Which is that maybe more obvious symbolism, but there's also the clashing, which we get in a bunch of different scenes. We have something clashing. And I think that this is like where I see the real interesting philosophical thing that McCarthy's doing, which is this dissonance between the symbolism that we should be, you know, quote unquote, should be understanding, which is this is damned, this is about predestination and, you know, whatever. But there's the other kind of symbolism, which is just dissonance, you know, and our inability to decide how we should read this. And that doesn't mean like, oh, maybe it's a good ending. You know, I think that in fact, it's maybe even more bleak than the negative symbolism. I think we're maybe in agreement on this, but, you know, the text won't tell us how to read it, which is even more maybe disturbing in certain ways than just saying, oh, these are evil people, or these are people who are damned, or whatever. You know, there's kind of no answer.
And that notion of the text not telling us how to read it, and the mixture of sensibility, which is often uncannily, like you could say, empirically incorrect, you know, once again, does bolster the notion of, you know, the Schopenhauerian view has just been, it's almost like been muddled, it's been bastardized, and you can't give yourself over to your normal sensibility. And of course, this is, you know, the question of the empirical question of the blind man at the end. There's almost a, one wonders if that's who, you know, it's like a blind Virgil in a way, like a blind Virgil in, it seems more like the underworld than hell, right? It's just, it's gray, you know, no one's like, okay, there's a lot of killing from the trio, but between these moments, which might be like moments where that had to happen or something, or is to do with color's agency, between those moments, it's not like some explicit hell of a medievalist sense. It's more like the underworld, right? It's more like this just gray sludge, occasionally seasoned with like, oh, that was a horrible moment, but I'm not really sure what it means, and nothing really has much to adhere to. And then, you know, amidst that, I mean, maybe the only person to you should or could cling to is the blind man. You know, that's smart. You know, thinking about any notion of goodness or respite at all in the novel. I mean, the fact that he smiles is probably one of the most important things, right? Like, he smiles to him. Maybe it's, you know, is it a smile of, I'll see you again when you want to get out? Now, you're still sort of trying to adhere to your decisions are the best. But, you know, but color doesn't, I mean, maybe, you know, a very stereotypical literary question. What would you make of color's progression? Do you see any there?
I'm not sure. I haven't really considered that one too much. I mean, I think you're right, because I think we're meant to think, on one hand, that Kala is this kind of naive, you know, figure, but I think that he knows a lot more than he lets on. You know, he's kind of affectless and maybe bored and certainly suffering. But also pretty indifferent, it seems. And so, you know, he's a good character for us to, you know, to be close to if we're trying to think about this kind of dissonance, right? Like, he has to give over his, right? He steals the boots, and then he has to trade his boots with this, you know, one guy in the trio wants his boots around the fire. And so he gives him the boots that he stole. And he gets these misshapen, you know, rank boots that smell terrible. And then, you know, and it's just kind of, well, he's continuing to like commit crimes and steal things. And interestingly, he's framed for things too, right? Like, there's a grave was desecrated and they like think it's him, but it wasn't him. Or and at the end, it's for nothing, right? There's no, it's not like he's amassing these, you know, good, not only good objects, but good experiences. You know, he's just kind of chased from place to place. And, and we never get much commentary on what he's thinking or what he's feeling. I do think, I mean, maybe there's a progression at the end. If we do at least see him wondering about the blind man, you know, that seems like a start on the right track for him, maybe. But,
well, you know, and it does bring us back to Schopenhauer. Okay. So this notion of, you know, the pendulum between boredom and suffering. I mean, color, most of the, as I said earlier, I think he's more bored, but of course there's a lot of suffering. But to the extent that one doesn't have an actual active relationship with the presumed Schopenhauerian negativity of both of these modes, okay, so for Schopenhauer, you know, the negative is the positive, because the negative always has more energy in the world, and it's a very crass way of putting it, but the negative existence is positive for Schopenhauer, because moments of positivity are so rare that they are actually the thing that is pushing down against the positive, which is the negative. But what happens to that negative where, one, the character perhaps has an intuitive relationship where they know, okay, this world, nothing's going to be illumined for me here. The light, metaphorically speaking, has done nothing and will do nothing. And then also, every time this character engages with a moment either of almost austere boredom, like austere non-existence, just because between the moment, the seasoned moment of true suffering with the trio that we would consider suffering, it is this real horrible, like just wandering, like aimless wandering.
Mm-hmm.
What if the true horror, maybe just to keep repeating that cliche, the true horror is that Colour has developed himself in such a way that he just does not, he's completely become almost immune to it. Just, it doesn't do anything for him anymore. You know, it's so much suffering and so much boredom that he's no longer bored and he's no longer suffering. He's, you know, a pure indifference, but also a pure indifference to liberation. You know, there's no liberation also, but he's accepted that. I mean, what is that character then that they have become purely indifferent to suffering, boredom, and liberation? It's almost like, I guess in therapeutic language, it's almost like, imagine the horror of someone who wanted to change themselves, and they go through years of trying to get to the crux of the issue. They accept the issue, and then they just don't want to push through that last bit of suffering. They're fine with it. They don't care. I mean, that is horrible. And maybe that's Colour, but I don't think there's something, dare I say it, there's something amicable about Colour. You think, man, come on, man, you know. I don't know. I mean, leaving him there at the end, I don't know. You want him to... I don't know. I don't know what you want. And I don't know. Maybe he just absolutely doesn't know either. But that notion of pure indifference, I don't know what you'd make of that. But yeah.
Well, I think importantly, you know, like we, even in moments of relative, you know, boredom... narratively, you know, there was a specific moment. I mean, I don't know, this will relate, I think, in some way, but I actually have a quote from Vereen Bell's, an article from 1983, the article, Ambiguous Nihilism of Cormac McCarthy. And it's talking about, there's a time in the little span in the novel where Rinthy takes up with this family, and she sort of is like helping them, and she's able to, you know, get, you know, have a bed in their house and everything. And there's this moment where she's kind of propositioned by a young man and sort of, you know, refuses. And then she's going back into the house at night. And there's a scene where she's getting into bed, and then, you know, she's sharing a room with a bunch of other people. So she hears the other people coming into bed, getting into bed. And there's this really, I think, palpable tension where it feels like, is she in danger here? You know, but nothing happens. So even these moments where we feel, where McCarthy somehow has created this tension where, you know, we do have horrible things happening and they're described, but you know, maybe it's the way that even those horrible things are described, we almost psych ourselves out into thinking that even when nothing is happening, I could be missing something, or something could be on the next page that would be described in three words, you know, that would totally shatter the rest of the novel. Right. But I want to read this quote here from Vereen Bell. Rinthy is not threatened here. She in fact has been taken in by responsive, if laconic, strangers. Nevertheless, the five pages that it takes to get Rinthy from washing up to bed are dense with alternating signals of strangeness, uncertainty, and reassurance. The command of the nuances of speech and narrative rhythm, of sounds and of visible objects, and even of silence, is unfaltering. The unlurid, almost pastoral occasion is a subtle microcosm, and the whole of the novel is the sum of such occasions. Each episode, the novel as a whole, and the texture of the prose itself express repeatedly a sense of the interwoven beauty and terror of life, which is the unassuming beginning and end of McCarthy's vision. What meaning there is remains inseparable from the sensation of experience. And then a little bit later on, the text says, one might characterize McCarthy's nihilism as not simply ambiguous, but dialectical. And then ultimately, in McCarthy's novels, form and meaning refuse to coincide. Experience, meanwhile, continues to insinuate questions while supplying no answers, leaving the articulate and the inarticulate alike fatefully free. So I feel like, on the one hand, within the novel, and this can apply to any character in any situation, I think there is this refusal to tell us how we're to judge it or how, on what level we should be thinking about it. But then, as well, on the larger level, concerning the idea that, you know, this is perhaps heavily allegorical, we do see that structure as almost like an empty, you know, or again, like an arbitrary, is the novel allegorical for the characters? You know, like, do they see this? I think that they want it to be, maybe, you know, Culla maybe wants it to be, like, he goes in search for work, but what is he even working for? Just to survive? Like, we never have any internal monologue really about what he's trying to do. So there is, I mean, I think this is also where we link up again with Schopenhauer, in the difficulty of understanding the place of the, almost like the personal versus the structural, or like the personal versus the impersonal. Because if experience is how we, for instance, break out of suffering, for Schopenhauer, right? Aesthetic experience, we have these like moments of timelessness. At the same time, he says that that's when we're contemplating the capital I ideas. So clearly there's some larger impersonal, structural, philosophical, almost like universal appeal to those moments. And yet I think that it's that simply reprieve from suffering. That's why we kind of want to get to those moments in the first place. It's not as if, you know, anyone who's having an aesthetic experience is concerned with philosophy, not necessarily, you know. Mm. And Culla, maybe he does just want to find work and has no reason for really doing so, and isn't actually some martyr or some kind of, you know, figure in a larger allegory.
So one thing I'd add in, because we haven't spoken much about Rinthy's story, and I was just, while you were speaking, I was wondering why that was in relation to what we've been speaking about. And perhaps it's a very nuanced understanding on McCarthy's half of active and passive nihilism from Nietzsche. So Rinthy's journey is far more innocent. She's lost in a very normal way, you know, and I think that is made explicit that she's, you know, she's lost. She's stumbling around all the time and sort of stumbling across things, and she's just doing what she can to get by and trying to avoid her brother while she does it. And I think maybe she's, you know, her... So it's almost an active and passive nihilism, but it's not placed upon any actual action. It's placed upon an aimless path. But Rinthy is accepting of the fact she's lost. She's, you know, she's accepting of that. It's not a great world. She is, you know, to repeat myself, accepting of that, and we're following that. And perhaps, you know, that's why Rinthy's journey didn't stick as much for me, is because it does come across as someone who is truly lost in this world. It has admitted this fact and has admitted that, and is just trying to get by. And I think maybe that's why she's rewarded with the sleep at the end. Like, she gets to get out in a way. Culla wakes up, she goes back to sleep. Whereas, you know, this active and passive nihilism, she's active on the aimless. She's like having an active relationship with it and accepting it. Whereas I think Culla is almost a horrible passive nihilist who understands the aimless, but he's passive about it. And so they're both on the same sort of absurd aimlessness, but Colors becomes more interesting because it's almost recursively aimless. Like, he does it, you know, I don't know. I mean, there's something distinctly horrible about how he comports himself throughout the world. It's, yeah, kind of grim.
Well, yeah, to add a little, or maybe to complicate that a little bit too, where she falls asleep is the same fireside where, you know, the baby was murdered, where the tinker was hung, and, you know, where the trio and Culla were. And we don't know when that is, right? We don't have a sense of where in the narrative this is, because the very next vignette is that final one, I think, where in years later. So we have Culla again at the end, and that's years later. So we don't know, but, you know, yeah, she falls asleep in this kind of glade, or, you know, sort of clearing, and where there was, you know, the burnt out fire, and she sees she's wearing rags. There's dust and ashes. And it's just kind of a horrible scene. Mm. So she falls asleep at this horrible scene. And maybe she is opening back on to some kind of more, in even more innocent state, I guess. Although it's not clear that she lost that at any point. Maybe there is some kind of positive thing about this sleep, but it still feels like we feel that, just like in the scene I described a few minutes ago, where she's getting into bed with, you know, in this house with all these strangers, it feels like there's some kind of danger, right? This was the scene of several crimes already, and those kind of roving trio could be, you know, hiding in the bushes or something, you know, like, not to get hypothetical, but it does feel like a very precarious sleep if it is, if that is her ending.
Speaking of ending, I mean, maybe just to wrap things up at the ending, I don't know, you know, what to say regarding, I mean, in a way that the book is one of possibly even cyclicity. Like, I'm not going to say it's literally a cyclic novel that goes back to the start, but there is a certain feeling of, you know, as you say with the sleep, I mean, maybe, you know, I possibly lean towards that she's getting out. She's at least going to sleep for a bit. She's, you know, tendency is when you go to sleep, you wake up. But she's getting some respite for a while, whereas Colour just he carries on.
Yeah, he has to keep being bored or suffering or whatever. Yeah,
and until he admits to that. I mean, the fact she lays down where she does is very much possibly a metaphor. But it's a tough one to sort of conclude in terms of, you know, because there isn't, maybe Rinthy has character progression.
Yeah.
I'm not sure about Colour.
I think part of
the stereotypical literary things, but as to the notion of where does this novel go, I'm not sure I could say.
I think McCarthy is, I mean, I think this is, again, the brilliant thing. So it's not only these tensions within the structure of does someone have character progression or not, it's a tension between that structure in itself, like whether we're talking about allegory, you know, how we're supposed to understand every scene, versus on the other hand, I don't usually think in terms of nihilism, I guess, but just a really, really radical ambiguity, or a really like a very serious uncertainty, you know, that I think is helpful certainly for thinking about a lot of the larger questions that we've been talking about throughout. But I think that, I mean, we also didn't even mention how beautiful like the prose is too. Oh, you know, I mean, read any page of this and it's incredible. The words he's using, I had to definitely look some up. And
well, his early, I mean, the early works are, I mean, I think the early works are the best. By, you know, I mean, you know, I keep saying to you, Sutri, like,
yeah, I got to get on that. Yeah,
but you know, He's far more of a prose stylist, and to be honest, I mean, his progression as a writer is gets through to this just harrowing minimalism in the last two novels, Passenger and Stella Maris. I mean, Stella Maris being its sort of its own thing, but yeah, I mean, and that's something that's a whole other discussion. But I mean, yeah, is there anything you want to add about Out of Dark that we haven't touched on?
Well, I have one thing that maybe. I want to read, because I think it's touching on the questions that we're having and maybe the problem we're having ending. Mm. So in SZ by Roland Barthes, which if you don't know it, it's in the height of his, you know, really intense structural period, where he essentially takes Sarrazine by Balzac and reads it sentence by sentence. So it's a very tedious book in many ways to read. But the way he ends the book, I'll just read this, and I think it will, I think maybe we'll find some connection here, and it might be a good place to end. So it's this section, that's just titled The Pensive Text. He says, "The classic text is pensive, replete with meaning. It still seems to be keeping in reserve some ultimate meaning, one it does not express, but whose place it keeps free and signifying. This zero degree of meaning, which is not its annulment, but on the contrary, its recognition, this supplementary, unexpected meaning, which is the theatrical sign of the implicit, is pensiveness. The pensive in faces and texts is the signifier of the inexpressible, not of the unexpressed. For if the classic text has nothing more to say than what it says, at least it attempts to let it be understood that it does not say everything. This illusion is coded by pensiveness, which is a sign of nothing but itself, as though having filled the text, but obsessively fearing that it is not incontestably filled, the discourse insisted on supplementing it with an et cetera of plenitudes. At its discreet urging, we want to ask the classic text, what are you thinking about? But the text, wilier than all those who try to escape by answering about nothing, does not reply, giving meaning its last closure, suspension. So I sort of feel like that's maybe a good place to end, because I feel in many ways that we've brought up all these questions that will remain in any reading or any thinking about this text, but the ability to, you know, decide which one is, you know, correct is kind of beside the point, I think.
Go read the book.
Yeah.
That's a good place to finish up. Brian Counter, thanks very much once again.
Thank you.